Thank you. No pressure.
No pressure.
Okay, thank you very much, Erica, by the way, for inviting me to come and speak today. So this paper discusses the intentional and unintentional smelly empirics of a recently completed multi-species ethnography. Otter predation at carp fisheries remains a high-profile concern of commercial fishery owners and clubs which operate fishing rights in the UK. In order to address these concerns, I embedded myself within an angling club and sought to encounter the animals present, including the humans, and rendered a notoriously elusive otter present within the space. What I'd like to explore today is how smelling, and the instrumentalisation of scent became such an operative feature of the ethnography. It reflects, I hope, the smelly materialities of field research and the sensuous vicissitudes of seeking the non-human. As such, it addresses calls within the animal geography's discipline to innovate new methodologies for exploring animal worlds. Oh. No. There we go. So the core question applicable to for the arrival of smell and smelling within the work came through the following. How does the manner by which these animals are enacted contribute to conditions of their conflict? Smelling became a major part of a seeking enactment of animal others in a variety of forms, but as will be shown, also pervaded the kind of multi-species of assemblage in more instrumental ways and nuanced ways to achieve exclusive and mimetic effects. This ethnography preceded by a desire for encounter to, in a sense, bring into material existence the discursive assemblage that had influenced the initial research design, informed by a Deleuzian desiring ethology. The body, human or non-human, can be known through its affects and becomings, its relations to the other or indeed anything. Affect, in this sense, describes the ineffable forces which interpenetrate and interconnect the relating bodies, the process, as Masumi notes in the Forward to a Thousand Plateaus, by which one body begins to become another, to relate to it and comprehend it via the interpenetration of milieu. Smell seems to fit this definition so neatly in its compulsive reactivity, as it is unconsciously processed in the limbic area of the mammalian brain. The mammal reacts, quite literally, to smell, precognitive thought. Operationalised within this research, these varied notions of affect could be read in the practices of seeking to make present non-human others, in the use of the body and in the utilisation of technology. So it is that I found myself on 2 days accompanied by a guide, wearing olive greens and camouflage clothing, walking softly and talking in a very low register. A gentle amble through environmental awareness, the presence of fungi noted and photographed, the slightest scrape of earth inspected for further signs of the culprit, the search for shine, as I learn it's called, the telltale show of mammalian bodies repeatedly gliding over the same earth. Eyes focus on details unprecedented, nostrils flaring to detect the slightest hint of animal. Scatological manifestations of fox are smelt before found, the rich and musty top notes logged and categorised in an olfactory memory slot. Get your nose on it, John. My guide jibed in a deep local vernacular. Indeed. Reluctantly, but without showing reluctance, I get as close to the abject as I dare. Yes, very distinctive. I stay confidently. Later, we are honoured to find both a fox scat and an otter sprained in close proximity, clearly a boundary of interspecies significance. Again, my olfactory memory and professional pride take precedence over existential horror. Otter sprain is more difficult to characterise, sharper, more acrid, with overtones of fish. Such thinking is, however, entirely relative. The poet Miriam Darlington describes the otter sprain as aromatic, like lavender or jasmine tea, perhaps with a hint of bergamot. I don't know what she was smelling, really. Scales are evident throughout, along with fur and bone. A confusing mixture, an exquisitely turned plop of ecology, punctuating a vector of travel, communicating a vernacular far beyond the human capacity to comprehend it. Being highly territorial animals, otters make a show of their presence through sprainting. This is characteristic of the mustelid family in general, having anal glands that produce a musky scent for marking territory and sexual signalling. You can see here the spots where on the first day out learning the sprains and other signs were found in really prominent spots, and this is absolutely characteristic of otters. They are even known to scrape up and craft bankside vegetation and mud into little mounds and leave a sprain on top of it for optimum communicative capacity. Bridges and raised walkways are classic sprainting spots, these kind of obligatory points of topographical passage under and over waterways, really. Finally, on day two, I found myself at an otter holt, well hidden, just above the tide line, with eyes now attuned to the mammalian shine and the differentials of tracks. It can be seen clearly the area was heavy used, and perhaps not just by otters. The nearest common use human path is 100 yards away across the river, too far for such evidence to be noticed from there without the most careful stare, really. Stills were taken, but it was the embodied memory, really, that I found most valuable. This sensuous journey through tracking, sight, smell and feel became the manual through which my explorations of the fishery sites would be conducted. So moving forward, I took these insights into the lakes to form the sort of fundament of the ethnography, really. All have a history of contact with otters. They're all run by the same club. They're all the historical result of ultimate open cast mining, reseeded with plant life, flooded and leased and sold for a sort of variety of purposes, really. My entombment within the club, however, took on a very, very different form. More an embedding in the discourse of the club members, a filtering of the actuality from fishing myth and legend. This required presence and work, really, sort of listening and grafting and not really questioning, because they already knew the sort of information you were after. In time, I learnt where I could find the largest fish and where it was likely that otters could be found and they might access the sites and leave occasional evidence. The Carpangas theory of high nouveau took the place of active nostrils, really, in the search for specimen carp. So much of what carp anglers seem to do reflects the notion of the carp's milieu and the sensual affects through which they apprehend their environment. Smell, taste, and its communicative capacity through water appear to be absolutely key to this. Taking bait types as an example, and there are some here, I accumulated several varieties which reflected different permutations of this, and it became a sort of opportunity for naive empirical encounter, really, or an approach to encounter. So I had sort of 25 kilograms of French maize, which between myself and my gatekeeper, we regularly fed into a particular part of a lake over the course of a few weeks. And it was thought that this would build confidence in the kind of lake's aquatic residents, and they would return and feed there and become accustomed to the food source. The HMV theory holds that carp are able to evaluate instinctively the nutritional value of a food source. And thus, the higher the nutritional value of the bait, the more likely it is to catch fish. Or so says theory, and a rather vast bait industry anyway. Indeed. This becomes a competitive arms race, really, for anglers seeking the same fish. Bait knowledge is closely guarded. The theory accounts for a plethora of additives and matriculations of bait design in the quest for the ultimate signifying mimic, really. Amino acids and pastes and compounds and flavours, feed stimulators, all designed to leak a signal of value into the water and thus to induce a feeding response from the carp. And the carp in themselves are recognised as this kind of canny and differentiating creature rather than bottom feeding mud sifters, really, you know. So some of the preparations on this slide. So I decided to test the theory and add spirulina to the maize as a personal twist. Spirulina is a blue-green algae superfood that can be purchased in human health food shops as tablet or dried powder for inclusion in other things. And it's described as the ultimate nutritional additive, high in nutrients and amino acids. This is reflected in the cost. It's £9 for 250 grams. Suggested an inclusion rate of 25 grams per kilo. I reduced this, being on a student budget, and and flavoured 5 kilograms of maize for a 24-hour session. In spring, carp wake up from a torpid state of near hibernation that finds them hungry for rich food sources and mineral worth, allegedly. It was my hope that spirulina would meet this need, if not the constant smell of decomposing seaweed in the kitchen appeared to be an unpleasant price to pay. The question, ontologically speaking, became, what does it mean if I catch a carp? was it just hungry and I was in the right space at the right time, or to reflect the romance of angling literature, had I lured a kind of cunning adversary into a novel moment's weakness through techno-effective mimicry? Here then is the experiment itself and its sort of interpenetration. You know, can the full exegesis of capture be distilled towards a single factor? Were the planets entirely in alignment, or did the spirulina account for some special moment between us? Over the course of 24 hours, a 24-hour session, I made contact with 5 different carp. The actuality of encounter, hefting these sort of hard, slimy, slippery weight of fish in small hours of the morning, fearing of causing any harm, a sort of head torch flicked onto sort of red light to cause sort of minimum reaction for them, scale patterns studied and photographed. It was an intensely visceral experience. The first fish, this one pictured here in fact, from the second 24-hour session, with this sort of stunning fish that showed predation damage. The top half of the tail fin had sheared away into tatters, and there were sort of suggestions of a healing puncture wound on the flank. With the carp lying there in the unhooking mat, I took my time to practice some first aid, as I'd been shown on an instructional video, sort of thick antiseptic liquid dabbed onto the wounds and the shredded tail with a large cotton bud, and watched it change colour as it reacted to the surface. The tender act was the sort of gentle release back into the water, really, the sort of dark and foreboding depths I tried not to fall into afterwards in the middle of the night. The neurobiological literature seems to bear out the HMV theory's fundamentals. You know, subsequent work on fish olfaction confirms the significant complexities of smell and taste in fish, always mediated by solubility in water. It was thought, in fact, that fish held only a single sensory complex for the olfactory and gustatory until approximately 1894, after which experiments in section of brain removal and blocking senses revealed the existence of 2 separate systems. Further, cyprinids, like carp, are known to have a particularly sophisticated olfactory sense with a particularly attuned sense towards amino acids. Additionally, very interestingly, cyprinids can detect predation of their own species through chemicals released through ruptured skin, a detection which produces a fright reaction. They get as far away as possible. So, moving on, the instrumental qualities of scent gained further novel application and complexity within the club that I was researching. They had been experimenting with non-lethal methods of deterring otters from predating on carp under licence from Natural England. One of these licences pertained to the olfactory deterrence in the use of distilled large predator dung that is used to form a cordon around the lake and hopefully write threat in a sort of scatological language that the otters might understand. The results were best summed up by the angling chairman here. We tried that for 18 months or so, and yeah, we didn't lose many fish. I was getting quite a nice cocktail. I was getting lion, tiger, jaguar, cheetah, bear, wolf even. So that's got to be giving off something to the wildlife, hasn't it? Was it working? Was it not? It's difficult to say. The next one really kind of sums it up, actually. My cat and dog weren't too bothered about it. I'll tell you what, though, the horses didn't like it. The horses went fucking nuts. The horses, their eyes came out of their heads and they just reared and ran off around the field, and that was just a sniff on my arm. I put it on the post of the horse field and cleaned it, and they sniffed the jacket and they sniffed it and they were off. You can imagine. So, hold your breath for the next slide. Lastly, sadly, the epilogue of Otter Encounter lacks the liveliness that I desired to witness. It is instead a cold, dead and very smelly creature that greets me in an early February. Braced for my part in assisting a post-mortem with colleagues in the biosciences department, I embrace a maximum of preconceptions over what is to follow, reminded of the excellent series Inside Nature's Giants, with its swarthy cast of science communicators and charismatic interdisciplinary public intellectuals. Organs and their purposes, relationships and their organs, bodies with organs removed, weighed and theorised. The truth is in the tissue samples. Dissection reveals the path by which the once vital creature walked and now finds itself here. Conversation quickly turns to smell. I'm informed that the post-mortem room is really reeking. The extractor fan has already been on for an hour. My guide explains her frustration at walking away from a day's work, not being able to shift the smell, being self-conscious about it in her social life. They take the cadavers out of the freezer a couple of days before to defrost. Gut check time. I take some controlled breaths to steady my nerves, mind, and stomach. "Oh, there it is," remarks my fellow assistant. "That is ripe." It takes a second or two to register, nostrils flaring deliberately to meet the coming challenge. The smell rises with a warmth and muddiness contained in earth and water. Moisture carried, it quickly becomes an all-pervasive feature, sinking from the nose through the back of the eyes and settling in the pit of the stomach. This churned and twisted for a moment, trying to locate the extent of the horror. I suppressed the sense viciously, consciously deprioritizing its input and focusing on a rational appraisal of the room and its contents. This worked for the time being. Bin bags were opened, sudden hilarity. In one bag there's an otter, small, curled up, like it's sleeping. The other bag contains a juvenile badger, a very smelly badger at that. The room is suffused with a thick, stale ammonia, mud and rot scent that is almost visible by this point. "How has anyone mistaken a badger for an otter?" someone states flatly. I steel myself against my own sensitivity, pull a rational curtain over floundering eyes and take shallow breaths that avoid the deep churning of my stomach. That's it. Thank you.